from deep inside your radio.
Okay, we're back at the Le Show Dome. I'm going to try as hard as I can on this particular broadcast, being back at home base. No guarantees. I mean, I know a wise Latina might do a better job with this show, but you got me, so what are you going to do? Ladies and gentlemen, a top counterinsurgency expert says Pakistan is not a lost cause. We're at the point where we're denying it's a lost cause. But without wholesale change, the country risks spiraling into lawlessness. Not retail change now. That's not enough. Australian David Kilcullen was the senior advisor to General Petraeus, helped engineer the surge strategy, i.e. paying off the Sunnis to switch sides until we stopped paying them. That was a good strategy. I don't think Pakistan's lost. We still have enormous support in some ways in Pakistan, but I do think we need to see a fairly wholesale change of heart coming from the Pakistani military. All right, then. We'll stand by for that. He's a theorist of asymmetrical warfare, formerly in the Australian Army. I think it's not an exaggeration to say that Pakistan is the most dangerous country in the world today, he said. And certainly in terms of counterterrorism and counterinsurgency problems, it is the problem that most worries me, and I think that should most worry Western policymakers. He says the size of the country and its nuclear capabilities create a unique set of problems for Western countries. Pakistan is a very developed country. There's a Pakistani diaspora across most other countries in Europe and North and South America, and it has more than 100 nuclear weapons. Gee, it wasn't any of those things 7 years ago when we decided to invade Iraq, was it? Oh, it was. Okay. Sorry. The government is progressively losing control of its own population and territory. And you've got Al-Qaeda sitting right in the middle of the country, so it's a very, very significant problem, unquote, Mr. Kilcullen. How come it wasn't the front line in the war? No. Meanwhile, ladies and gentlemen, the kind of war, you know, there's always a debate, at least in theological circles or some theological circles, as to whether there is such a thing as a moral or just war. And certainly in the recent past, we've had reason to question that concept again. Is there such a thing as a good war? I think I found one. Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi's long and profitable friendship with media mogul Rupert Murdoch is apparently over. The two are at war. Berlusconi has accused Murdoch of ordering negative stories about him, Berlusconi. I don't want to be nasty, but the episode on Sky News, owned by Murdoch, where, well, I'll explain in a moment, created a rift with Sky and Murdoch, which has been followed by a series of highly critical articles about me, Berlusconi said, on one of the three television channels he owns. The episode was the decision by Berlusconi's government last December to double the rate of taxes, VAT, on satellite television to 20%. Murdoch's Sky Italia achieved a monopoly in Italy on satellite television with the aid of Berlusconi. The channel saw the jump in the tax rate as a calculated attack. A furious Murdoch unusually appeared in person at the Sky Italia headquarters to denounce the tax increase. He saw it as a direct assault on his business. He ordered advertising spots lambasting the Berlusconi government. During the Easter break, Sky Italia broadcast a film called Shooting Silvio, which revolved around a man's plan to rid Italy of Berlusconi with a bullet. Aides of Berlusconi said the film was an incitement to violence. People close to Berlusconi and Murdoch agree they are virtually at war. I'm telling you, good war. No, you don't have to root for either side. Just root for the war. It's no secret the relationship between the pair has got very nasty indeed in the last 12 months, a source at Sky Italia said. Berlusconi has been in the news owing to his wife deciding to sue for divorce over the 18-year-old lingerie model who calls the prime minister daddy. I don't see Rupert hanging around with lingerie models. Maybe I do have a rooting interest. And his decision to run a raft of starlets as candidates in the European election today. Berlusconi's company is planning this summer to introduce its own satellite TV service to compete with Murdoch's. As I say, ladies and gentlemen, it's a good day when you can find a good war. Hello, welcome to the show. From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And this is, it's just after one D-Day and just before the next. Which?
High def, low def, no def, take my hand. It's a digital wonderland. Got to be so careful where you stand. in the digital wonderland.
Yes, this coming, I don't know what day it is. June 12th, I believe, is the official changeover. I think it's Friday. When American television stations switch off the analog signal and go digital on you. They go all digital on your ass. From the Wall Street Journal, no one knows for sure what will happen on June 12th. That's the acting chairman of the FCC, Michael Copps. He's copsing out. Quote, no one knows how much disruption there will be. Unquote. He doesn't say how much or how little, just how much. That's a clue. Milwaukee, was just there last week. Milwaukee's CBS affiliate and one of its sister stations will, despite the deadline for switching off the analog signal, will continue to broadcast in analog after the deadline, after D-Day. The owner, Weigel Broadcasting, announced that the programming of the CBS affiliate will air in analog on Channel 63, even though it's been Channel 58 up till now. The executive said maintaining analog broadcasts of the stations will provide a lifeline to viewers who haven't prepared for the digital transition. Unfortunately, not all homes in our viewing area are prepared in full or in part for the digital transition, says the general manager of Weigel's Milwaukee stations. Those homes still need to be able to receive vital news information. Unfortunately, of course, American local TV stations haven't been broadcasting vital news information for quite some time, but they're going to start now because of the thing. A lifeline, ladies and gentlemen, you know, because in case there's flooding or a thing and you're not ready to receive digital television, well, of course, digital radio will help, won't it? Your HD tuner on the Zune and the New York Times chimes in. Now, this story, as you know, I've been thumping this tub for a long, long time about how crazy it is that we are being forced to upgrade, quote unquote. Because the last time we upgraded television, it was to color, and we all wanted to do it, and it happened just fine. Anyway, the New York Times waits until this weekend to put a story on the front page about this. And the Times says millions of households will lose television reception when the transition occurs. And they're quoting federal officials. I don't know if they're quoting Michael Copps. Here's an interesting figure in calculating all of this. Ladies and gentlemen, the federal government has spent more than $2 billion just to ease the transition to digital television with those coupons and, you know, advertising campaigns. $2 billion just to make it easier to go from analog to digital television. And still, millions of people aren't with the program. No better use for the money could have been found, of course, but $2 billion. The latest survey by the Nielsen Company indicates that as of the end of May, more than 10% of the households that own television, that's 114 million, are either completely or partly unprepared. 10%. That's a lot of households. You could have a hit show with that many households. Or a hit lack of show, as the case may be. Let's spend some more billions. What do you say? Because it's TV. It's important. The digital wonderland, ladies and gentlemen, hop in. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. Sure, you got to have a little drum thing. From McClatchy Newspapers. Not carried widely, this report, so it's pretty much outside the bubble to you. Why did President Obama reverse his decision to release those detainee abuse photographs? According to McClatchy's Nancy Youssef, he did it after Iraqi Prime Minister al-Maliki warned that Iraq would erupt into violence and that Iraqis would demand that U.S. troops withdraw a year earlier than planned. This according to two U.S. military officers, a senior defense official, and a State Department official. In the days leading up to the May 28th deadline to release the photos, in response to an ACLU lawsuit, U.S. officials led by the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Christopher Hill, told Maliki that the administration was preparing to release photos of suspected detainee abuse taken from 2003 to 2006. It's a lot of bad apples, 3 years. When U.S. officials told... It's a veritable orchard. It's a bad orchard. When U.S. officials told Maliki, he went pale in the face, said a U.S. military official, who requested anonymity because of the matter's sensitivity. The official said Maliki warned that releasing the photos would lead to more violence that could delay the scheduled U.S. withdrawal from cities by June 30th, and that Iraqis wouldn't make a distinction between old and new photos, unlike the business executives who are approached by New Orleans convention officials who still say, isn't the city still underwater? Because they still see the old footage on CNN. The public outrage and increase in violence could lead Iraqis to demand a referendum on the security agreement and refuse to permit U.S. forces to stay until the end of 2011. Maliki said Baghdad will burn if the photos are released, said a second U.S. military official. A U.S. official who's knowledgeable about the photographs told McClatchy at least two of them depict nudity. One is of a woman suggestively holding a broomstick. One shows a detainee with bruises but offered no explanation how he got them. And another is of hooded detainees with weapons pointed at their heads. Of course, if they're hooded, they wouldn't know about the weapons. It was not so much the photos themselves, but the perception they would be Abu Ghraib-type photos, added the senior defense official, who said U.S. officials were worried about the potential street consequences of making the photos public. With tension rising again in major Iraqi cities, Maliki feared that if you add the photos to that mix, it could very easily provide an incentive to the extremists to use more violence, the State Department official said. That, in turn, might cause U.S. and Iraqi commanders to reconsider the troop withdrawal from urban areas, which would be a major setback to Maliki's government and to the Obama administration. After U.S. officials notified Maliki, the prime minister put heavy pressure on Hill and Army General Raymond Odierno, the top U.S. military commander in Iraq, to stop the release. Obama and Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said they changed their minds largely because of objections from U.S. commanders in the field, but they never mentioned Maliki's objection. Odierno's spokesman declined to comment, citing ongoing litigation. Well, litigation is always ongoing. That's why they have courts. The senior U.S. defense official said that Ambassador Hill and Commander Odierno were the primary voices urging Obama to reverse his decision. It took considerable lobbying by Odierno and Gates before the president changed his mind, the senior defense official said. So, just a little insight into the workings of Mr. Maliki. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. There's news about something I've talked about on this broadcast, not recently, maybe 3-4 years ago. I shared with you a spate of stories on the subject of genetically modified organisms in food, GMOs. Not to be confused with GM. GMOs are not bankrupt. They're doing good. They're doing well. And the latest battleground seems to be over beets. Sugar beets, specifically. Not beetroot. Sugar beets. Not beets. Sugar beets. Have I made that clear? Okay. I don't have to repeat it anymore. Thank you. First of all, in a story about whether organically modified sugar beets should be grown in Oregon, just a little fact dropped in the middle of that story. Apparently, already 90% of the sugar beets grown in this country are genetically modified. Mm-mm. Hand me the Splenda. But that's not all. from Oregon comes word that at least one seed producer is concerned that genetically modified organisms pose a serious threat to Oregon's vegetable seed industry. Roundup Ready Sugar Beets, a patented variety engineered by Monsanto. Why? It's genetically modified to resist or to tolerate the herbicide Roundup. Roundup Ready Sugar Beets have turned up in a soil mixture being sold to gardeners at a landscaping supply business just a few miles from organic seed producer Frank Morton's fields. He fears some of those roots may now be sprouting in local gardens. If so, they could soon start to bolt, sending out clouds of pollen that could fertilize his crop of golden chard, a closely related plant, and render it worthless for the organic seed market. It would also negate years of breeding that went into producing an especially cold, hardy line. Worse yet, Morton says the genetically modified sugar beets could cross-pollinate the fields of other chard growers in the area who supply seeds to major bagged salad distributors in California, potentially introducing genetically modified chard into the food system without the approval of federal regulators. I'd say we've got maybe 2 weeks to find it before it starts shedding pollen, Morton said. I think we've got a ticking time bomb on our hands, unquote. All right, time to start torturing Monsanto executives. It's a ticking time bomb. That's when you torture, isn't it? Yeah. It's genetically modified. It's got to be good for us. It's got to be. It's almost as good as if it were digital. Ladies and gentlemen, that's how good it is. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, you've heard of them, they're the good people at FEMA, must accelerate development of the plans to improve the nation's ability to respond to a national catastrophe. Improve them. That's according to the General Accountability Office. The GAO has found 68% of the plans needed to implement a national preparedness system have or have not been completed. Guesses? The have-nots are correct. Although 41 of 50 policies needed to define the roles and responsibilities of those who must implement the plan have been completed. See how they do this? Included in the plans that have not been completed are several designed to deal with catastrophic incidents, like, say, Katrina, according to the report. As a result, the roles and responsibilities of key officials involved in responding to a catastrophe have not been fully defined and thus cannot be tested in exercises. Katrina pointed out the need for such programs, the GAO said, noting the lack of clarity in response roles and responsibilities among the diverse set of responders contributed to the disjointed response. That's too many response syllables in one sentence, boys. Take that back to the rewrite shop. Moreover, the report said the lackluster response to Katrina highlighted the need for clear integrated disaster preparedness and response policies and plans. Although best practices for program management call for a plan that includes key tasks and their target completion dates, FEMA does not have such a plan. This is the new FEMA. The Department of Homeland Security, the parent agency of FEMA, agreed with its report's findings, said the GAO. I don't know if that means they're going to do anything about it, but they agree. And that's a good sign. And speaking of which,
he's not a general. He commands no troops. He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an inspector general. Oh, yeah.
A federal safety inspector assigned to the airline involved in an air crash that killed 50 people in upstate New York in February warned of safety problems at that airline a year before the accident. An attorney for FAA Inspector Christopher Monteleone said he reported problems with the flight testing program at Colgan Air for its newly acquired Bombardier-8Q400s in January 2008. That's the plane that crashed February 12th near Buffalo Airport. Among the problems Monteleone reported was that the Colgan test pilot exceeded the permissible speed limit and had difficulty properly landing the plane, is all. Test pilots typically are an airline's most skilled pilots. and are expected to train other pilots on how to fly new aircraft. But Colgan, a regional air carrier, complained to the FAA about Monteleone, the inspector. His supervisor reassigned him to desk work and ordered him to have no further contact with the airline. When Monteleone continued to press for action on safety concerns at Colgan and what he alleged was a cozy relationship between the agency and the airline, he was transferred or reassigned three more times, according to his lawyer. In March, he had a confrontation with an FAA attorney and was placed on administrative leave by the agency. He's filed a whistleblower complaint. The FAA spokeswoman declined to discuss personnel actions. Doesn't that make you feel good? Ladies and gentlemen, Newt Gingrich this week retracted his use of the word racist in reference to Sonia Sotomayor, the nominee by President Obama to be on the Supreme Court. Dick Cheney this week endorsed the idea of gay marriage. Rush Limbaugh this week, probably just rhetorically, said he was withdrawing as the titular head of the Republican Party. What the heck is going on? We'll dig deep, deep underground, for the answers moments from now here on the show.
Make it ride his own mighty cloud of joy.
Next, intimate tales of America's first underground vice president. The action-packed diary of the man who was just a heartbeat away from history.
Dick Cheney, confidential. Lynn once told me that Woody Allen once said that 90% of success is showing up. As usual, the little New Yorker was dead wrong. Time fillers show up. Bureaucrats show up. Saps show up. Success comes to those who don't necessarily show up where you expect them to, say at a foreign president's funeral or at an endless Senate debate. But they do show up where they sense they have the opportunity to make a difference. Secret meetings of the principals to devise interrogation strategy, for example. So as spring began its inexorable betrayal into summer, it occurred to me that having operated the levers of power in the United States government for so many years without the hindrance of fingerprints, it was time to perform the same service for an institution even closer to my pacemaker, the Republican Party. An old pal of mine from my lost years of exile in the House, Newt Gingrich, was stepping up his public profile. Poor guy is still dreaming of being president. Having actually done the job, I can't quite understand the fever, but I sure can recognize the symptoms. So I decided to pay him a visit, part of a little assignment I call Operation Take Reins of Party for Good of Country. Tuesday, 11:17 a.m.
We'll be right outside the door, Mr. Vice President.
Thanks, fellas.
You sure carry a lot of security, Mr. Vice President.
Call me Vice. Yeah, Mr. Speaker. Decision was reached that with the former president in Dallas, I probably needed some of his contingent added to mine.
Interesting. Who made that decision?
Well, in the absence of explicit directions to the contrary, appears that I did.
Of course. Being out of office is just another place to be in power.
Yeah, I like to think so. So, Newt, I don't watch the tube, but I hear you're all over the TV like a political Ryan Seacrest, whoever that is.
Yeah, well, in the interest of renewing American civilization, you do have to go to the place where it's been getting old. Mm-hmm. And Roger Ailes over at Fox has been kind enough to book me whenever I ask him to, so...
Oh, that's great. I've been doing more than my share of staring at interviewers' lavaliers as well. Difference between us, my friend, is that I know how to stay on message. You, on the other hand, are all over the place. One day you're all over Nancy Pelosi's backside.
Well, not literally.
No, of course not.
No.
Next day you're calling Obama's Supreme Court selection a racist.
Well, Pelosi stopped responding. Story lost its legs. I was in danger of being bumped off the Hannity show by Mark Levin.
Hey, my friend. Welcome to the club. Greta Van Susteren bumped me one night for somebody named Drew Peterson. I don't let that disrupt my agenda. Petty personal matters can't be allowed to interfere with what's important for our party.
Oh, I agree. And what's important is a forward-looking paradigm shift that emphasizes new leadership for the start of a decade of immense change.
Oh, save it for the junior college syllabus, my friend. What's important is looking forward by making sure that dedicated public servants who stepped up when most of the country was paralyzed by well-deployed fear, that those servants aren't the victims of vindictive and political prosecutions. Every minute you keep hammering so-called Speaker Pelosi about the interrogation briefings is a minute she can't spend attacking John Yoo, J. Bybee, even me. Enough of those minutes. You get her more hobbled than a syphilitic calf at the rodeo.
Now, Dick, I respect your need to stay out of prison, of course, but this is a moment when the party's leadership vacuum is being filled. If it isn't by me, it's going to be by Huckabee or Romney or Palin. Those are ideas, people, Mr. Vice President. All due respect. Not a single one of them has read Alvin Toffler.
Shoot, Ned, I haven't read Alvin Toffler either, but I'll tell you what I have read. The information the Vice President's office gathered while I was there regarding your divorces and annulments. Specifically, what you had to offer as inducement to turn divorce number two into annulment number one. Might make some people a bit cynical about your recent conversion. I don't think we'd want that in the early days of a presidential bid. Now would we?
Mr. Vice President, I have to be honest with you. I'm feeling my paradigm shifting.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I was kind of out front on calling Sotomayor a racist, along with our friend Mr. Limbaugh.
I think a simple apology gets you out of that mess and back into this one, where, if you ask my opinion, you belong.
Oh, I always welcome your opinion, Dick, but apologizing seems dangerously close to flip-flopping, especially when we're trying to renew American civilization.
Let me tell you something, Mr. Speaker. I came out in favor of gay marriage this week. You think I wanted to?
Well,
you think I'm going to enjoy being lambasted by our friends on the right as being on the slippery slope to endorsing bestiality? I have a daughter whom I want out on the talk show circuit, supporting enhanced interrogations and our entire comprehensive, robust treatment strategy. Said daughter wanted something from me. And it wasn't the keys to the family Buick. You just look straight ahead, reverse your position in the closest thing to a monotone you've got, and move forward.
Well, Mr. Vice President, you know I'm going to do the right thing. That's my whole positioning. Now, if you excuse me, I'd love to continue this chat, but I'm late for Twitter.
Yeah, he twitters all right. Like a sparrow with ADD. Which only left me one more bit of heavy lifting for the week. A flight down to West Palm Beach. No, I wasn't working on a secure undisclosed tan. Something a little bit more bombastic. Thursday, 4:17 p.m.
Mr. Vice President, always good to see you, sir.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on my way out to the golf course. You want to shoot a few holes?
Oh, no thanks, Rush. Might shoot one of them in the face.
That's a good one, sir. Mm-hmm. Good to see that being out of power hasn't damaged your sense of humor.
Oh, being a laugh riot has always been a particular passion of mine, Rush. As has a little project I call Operation Don't Prosecute Me.
Mm-hmm.
At one time, I thought you were a supporter.
Well, sir, I have had my plate a little full the last few weeks with the attacks from Colin Powell and the MSNBC crowd. After all, there's just so much of a daily three-hour show I can devote to subject other than myself.
My friend, I got out of my own particular tussle with the good general almost before I got into it. The guy folds like a wet doily.
Mm-hmm.
You don't look stronger for mixing it up with him.
Mm.
Quite the opposite.
Yeah. No, I just meant that...
Hope that wasn't your honorary member of Congress plaque from our friend Newt.
Think it was.
No, that is a pity. Almost as big a pity as reading about your annulments and divorces.
No, that is Newt.
I mean, almost as great a pity as rereading the emails from Alberto Gonzalez to the prosecutor in your OxyContin case.
Well, Mr. Vice President, I noticed you were a guest on Bill Bennett's radio show this week. I told Mr. Snerdley to ask you if you'd be a guest on mine. Get the fire started on this whole bogus torture thing again. Matter of fact, I was going to ask you personally before the vandalism and the threat, but now it really seems to be as good a time as any.
Rush, nobody I'd rather share the non-leadership of the Republican Party with than you, my friend.
Oh, same here, sir. Mr. Snerdley will set a date with you. I'm late for my foursome.
Maybe Rush didn't need the persuasive push of enhanced intimidation. But like the little New Yorker says, it couldn't hurt. End of partial diary for early June 2009. Sincerely yours, Dick Cheney. Confidential.
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 Let me teach you how to jive and well. Oh, you gotta
gotta jump jive. Then you will, they 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 gotta jump jive. Then you will, oh well. Hey! Papa's in the icebox looking for a can of ale. Mama's in the backyard learning how to jive and wail. Oh, you gotta jump jive. Then you will, 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 wail. Wail! Sure knows how to jive and will. Oh, you gotta jump jive. Then you will, 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 you gotta jump jive. Then you will. Jill went up a hill to fetch a pail. Well, Jill stayed up, wanted to learn how to jive and will. Oh, you gotta jump jive. Then you will, they 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 gotta jump jive. Then you will.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
First, from Fox Television News, Fox News Channel's Bill O'Reilly.
A rare correction on the fact. Earlier this week, I said that only Anderson Cooper on CNN covered the murder of Private Long in Arkansas. Well, today, a snide and surly guy on CNN pointed out that the story was covered more extensively by that network, and that is true. I was wrong. My apologies to CNN. I was talking about primetime, but I did not say that. And so I was wrong. As they say in third grade, my bad. Now, on Monday, we'll have more on how...
Well, forget Monday. Forget your plug. They say that in third grade, huh? Interesting how he manages to insult more people than he assuages with an apology. That's neat. That's good. That's a technique. Speaking of media apologies, New York Times reporter and columnist and blogger Andrew Ross Sorkin says, "Boy, did I touch the third rail in my recent appearance on MSNBC. My offhanded comment was admittedly flip. I apologize for that. It was meant to provoke a conversation. I did not mean to suggest that there are literally no successful companies that employ union workers. Of course there are. I made the unscripted comment with my financial columnist hat on in the context of the problems at GM. But let's leave that debate for another day. A Hawaii state judge has apologized for barring journalists from tape recording and photographing a hearing last week in Waianae District Court. Judge Clyde Sumida said he should have allowed members of the local news media to take photos and tape record the arraignment of Sandra Maloney, a resident accused of killing a peacock with a baseball bat. Yeah, I would have liked to have seen that hearing. Upon further review, I realize I misconstrued the requirements of the extended coverage rule as applied to this case, and the photographs and tape recordings of the proceedings should have been permitted. Please accept my sincere apology for the inconvenience I've caused, he said in an email. Speaking of Silvio Berlusconi, the ex-boyfriend of the 18-year-old lingerie model at the heart of the scandal involving Berlusconi has apologized for having fueled speculation about a presumed relationship between the two. In the letter, the ex-boyfriend, Gino Flaminio, said there never could have been a sexual relationship between Berlusconi and Naomi Letizia, quote, knowing Naomi and her values, unquote. All right, then. Dateline Redondo Beach, California, professional skateboarder Jareem Rogers has apologized for a naked rooftop rant at his Redondo Beach, California home, officials say. According to the Los Angeles dog trainer, the 24-year-old Rogers allegedly went on his roof naked early Monday morning, preaching from the rooftop before Redondo Beach Police Lieutenant Jim Acquarelli climbed onto the roof and talked him down. Rogers apologized later this week, saying he had eaten some psychedelic mushrooms that caused him to, quote, bug out, unquote. He was hospitalized for observation. Dateline Toronto Blue Jays outfielder Alex Rios apologized Friday after he was caught on video yelling profanities at a fan. The incident, which was posted on YouTube, happened Thursday night as Rios was leaving a gala dinner for the Blue Jays charity. He's seen in the YouTube video walking to his car along with a woman after the event when he appears to ignore an autograph request from a young fan. An older man yells at Rios saying, "The way you played today, Alex, you should be lucky somebody wants your autograph." Rios responds with a profanity, then swears again after the fan calls him a bum. Rios did strike out 5 times in 5 at-bats in a loss to the Angels on Thursday. He apologized before batting practice for Friday's game, saying, quote, "I lost my cool. I just want to apologize for the situation that happened yesterday. I just want to apologize to my fans, to the team, to my teammates, because it was something I should never have done. It was a bad reaction on my side. That's not the person that I am. You shouldn't act like that." Frustration with his poor performance had led to his outburst, he says. Dateline suburban Dallas, Don Jones, a vice chairman of the Collin County Republican Party, has apologized for an email that some local judges denounced as racist. She also lashed out at judges who forwarded her email and condemned her. "If someone is offended by something in an email, I don't think forwarding it on to 50 other people that never originally saw it is really prudent. That action simply multiplies the offensive email and enlarges the damage," she said. Dateline Salinas, California, the man identified as the chemist who caused the massive warehouse explosion a week ago apologized Friday, saying he's sorry and hopes for forgiveness. Mike Delmar said he was mixing a product called hexamine with menthol to make an additive for paint. Delmar said he was leasing the space in the warehouse during his after-business-hours experiment. He said things went terribly wrong. He said the pressure and temperature gauges on the vessel, which holds the chemicals, started hissing. He heard a popping sound and saw the temperature gauge way over its limit. He saw a big ball of fire and smoke and ran for the exit. A 4-mile stretch of an irrigation ditch nearby is tinted greenish-blue from the pigments that flowed down a storm drain from the warehouse explosions. Numerous fish and amphibians have died, but it's not toxic to humans. San Diego County rescinded a warning citation to the Jones family Bonita for holding Bible study in their home, and the county's top administrator also issued a formal apology. Pastor David Jones and his wife had received a warning in April from a county code enforcement officer for hosting a religious assembly in their home without first obtaining a permit. The Joneses maintained their First Amendment rights. Obviated the need for a permit. Ashley Simpson has apologized to her husband's ex-girlfriend, Michelle Trachtenberg, after launching a vicious verbal attack on the actress at a party in Los Angeles Monday night. Enough about that. Actress Melissa Joan Hart has publicly apologized for comments she made about ailing actress Farrah Fawcett. She took to her MySpace.com blog after realizing her remarks about her recent People magazine cover shoot had sparked a little scandal. Hart said she hoped Fawcett didn't die and cost her the cover of People magazine. It has come to my attention something I said has been completely misconstrued. I was merely explaining what I had read about how the cover of People magazine was chosen. I truly hope Farrah and her family know I wish them the best, and I would never be so selfish as to disrespect anyone, let alone someone I admire greatly. Deadline Greenwich, Connecticut. The Greenwich police chief has apologized to residents for not notifying them in advance of a SWAT team drill Wednesday at an abandoned house that alarmed neighbors and startled horses in the northwest part of town. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature for this broadcast. General Motors has entered bankruptcy. Goodbye, Pontiac. Goodbye, Hummer. Saturn has been sold to Roger Penske. We don't know what's happening to Saab. Dealers are being closed down. President Obama says he doesn't really want to be in the car business. Apparently, neither do the executives of GM either. It's a new and smaller GM.
Well, you used to rule the streets and the track like a fuel-burning giant. You fought hard so your engines wouldn't be pollution compliant. You and your brother cars prospered by being defiant. And you had such good fun till Obama took the company away.
Such good fun till Obama
little
took the
GT
away.
Well, you had a rotten winter, you're looking at a crappier summer. You're closing down Pontiac, looking hard to dump your Hummer. Bankruptcy fight, being owned by the feds is a bummer. And you had such big fun till Obama took the company away. Little GM.
Still gotta drive. Where we gonna work if you don't survive?
Well, you're shutting down dealers, cleaning it out like a Swiffer.
Yeah, you're cleaning it out.
Going 60 to 0, maybe your mileage will differ.
Yeah, you're cleaning it
out. Came in a hot rodder. You had such big fun till Obama took the company away. Little GM, shifting down to first. You were never the best. You were never the worst. All that's left is a big fire sale. Little GM.
Yeah, I'm still here. Wondering what happened to the rest of the music. Seems to have gone away. gone away. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's the wacky nature of show business. There was going to be more music, and there isn't. There was going to be much more music. This is not your much more music station. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, that is going to put a gas cap on this edition of the show. Actually, there's one more item I can share with you if there's no music at hand. The Obama administration's plan to boost aid to Afghanistan is shaping up as a boon to private contractors, including a company whose previous work on U.S.-funded Afghan aid programs has been criticized by inspectors general. So, the more change things, department. As I say, that's the end of this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at this same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network. Think of it. Up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin. Around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived, whenever you want it, harryshearer.com, kcrw.com. Available as a free download to members at www.audible.com/LeShow. Available for your smartphone at stitcher.com. And available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And also available streaming throughout the day Sunday at public radio stations you can find at www.publicradiofan.com. And it'd be just like us having music behind all this if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All righty. Thank you very much. Uh-huh. A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. If you're in the Philadelphia area and want to see an amazing show, go check out Richard Thompson's Cabaret of Souls in State College. Nice drive from either Pittsburgh or Philly, Wednesday night at 7. You will be amazed. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. Won't you?